that. God bless the Chicago White Sox for helping the Twins clinch two games every day. Two games. Shorten that magic number by twos. All right. Good afternoon, everyone. It's 1:30 p.m. on September 22nd, 2010. This is the North Dakota Public Service Commission meeting at a regularly scheduled biweekly meeting. On the 12th floor of the North Dakota Capitol is Kevin Kramer, along with Brian Kulk, and Commissioner Tony Clark joins us by phone as he's traveling today. Well, welcome, everyone. We do have a pretty meaty and lengthy agenda today, so we'll want to get through it because we also have some travel plans for later today. I say we loosely. I do, anyway.
As do I.
Yeah. So anyway, welcome, everyone, and turn it over to my colleagues for any opening comments or words of welcome.
Well, I would just offer thank you all for coming out today. I see we have Brian Howell here, new man from the media with KFYR, and also the Bison won last week, so I'll keep you up to date on that.
Just good afternoon.
Appreciate that. With that, I'd move passage of items in the consent agenda.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Moving on to the regular agenda. KC1 was just passed, I guess, on consent. KC2. I move the commission approve revision number 15 to surface coal mining permit number NACT0401, held by the Coteau Properties Company for the Freedom Mine, to identify the next five-year coal removal sub-areas and to update other information and plans for the next permit term.
Second.
Of course, this is the traditional or standard operation for revisions every 5 years, of course. The companies come have to both revise and, of course, then renew for another 5 years the mining on each permit area. This is the first motion of two motions to complete that process for this particular part of the Coteau mine. It, of course, does all the usual things, identifying the next five-year coal removal areas, addresses the items by the Reclamation Division during the pre-renewal review of the permit, and then, of course, it updates all of the information, business entities, owners, all of those types of things.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
In KC3, the companion to KC2, I move the commission approve renewal number 1 to surface coal mining permit number NACT0401, held by the Coteau Properties Company for the Freedom Mine, to extend the permit term on the existing permit area for another 5 years until September 26th, 2015.
Second.
This is, as I said, related to the previous action. It is to permit the company to continue mining operations within the existing permit area for the next 5 years. 5 years from now, we'll do it all again.
All in favor?
Aye. KC4. I move the commission adopt the order to affirm notice of violation number 1003 issued to the Coteau Properties Company at the Freedom Mine, cancel the informal conference that was scheduled in the matter, and then close the case.
Second.
As you'll recall, a notice of violation was issued to Coteau Properties Company on July 8th of this year as a result of a pond discharge that resulted in some minor erosion outside of the permit area. The violation was issued for failure to have an energy dissipator on the discharge outlet at the pond, and then for locating the discharge pipe beyond the permit boundary as required. On the 29th of July, Coteau filed a request for an informal conference, which then triggers a requirement by the commission to assess the proposed penalty and then schedule the informal conference. We proposed a civil penalty of $1,000, $250 of it for seriousness and $750 for negligence on August 24th at our commission meeting then, and then scheduled the informal conference for September 30th of this year. On September 1st, the company paid the proposed penalty and then withdrew its request for the informal conference. Coteau has completed the remedial measures, and then the NOV was terminated on July 22nd. Everything seems to be in order.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 KC5. I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, the conclusions of law and order issuing corridor certificate number 115 and route permit number 125 to Bridger Pipeline, LLC, for its oil pipeline in McKenzie, Dunn, and Billings Counties of North Dakota, case number PU09750.
Second.
As I was reading the order on this one, I was struck by how quickly this one has come around. Not that we weren't aware of the project given its letter of intent, but it was on July 23rd that Bridger filed a combined application for the certificate of corridor compatibility and then the rail permit to construct about 77 miles of 12-inch crude oil pipeline in McKenzie, Dunn, and Billings counties. On August 4th, we found that the application was complete and issued a notice of filing and notice of hearing and held that hearing on September 9th of this year in Kildare at the City Hall. What Bridger is proposing here is the construction of a brand-new 12-inch line from a point just north of Highway 23, about 15 miles west of the Four Bears Bridge in McKenzie County, then to an interconnection with their Heart River pipeline at the Skunk Hill Junction, which is about 18 miles northwest of Dickinson. The northern half of the line will generally parallel the Dakota gasification CO2 line, which we're familiar with. Of course, we had cited that previously. Yeah, that's in McKenzie County. And then the southern half will generally follow the most direct route northeast to southwest to connect with the Skunk Hill Junction. One of the interesting, I think, most advantageous pieces of this particular project are the fact that this pipeline will provide pipeline transportation of crude oil produced in McKenzie, Dunn, and Montreal counties from the Bakken to three potential markets. One to the Guernsey, Wyoming via the Bridger's Heart River and Little Missouri systems and the Butte pipeline system. Another is to Clearbrook, Minnesota, of course, through the Enbridge pipeline using the Belle Fouche pipeline's connection at Alexander. And then, of course, the third being the Tesoro High Plains pipeline through Belle Fouche's existing connections at Treetop, which would, of course, ship it then to the Tesoro plant at Mandan. The access to those three different markets by Bakken crude, of course, again, gives that that leverage, if you will, the pricing leverage, a little bit more of it to the producer and the seller rather than so much to the purchaser. The project does, as I said earlier, consist of 77 miles of 12-inch pipeline. Interesting in all of that is that when we first, I think, received the letter of intent, it was when we first heard talk of it, it was an 8-inch pipeline. It became a 10-inch pipeline in the letter of intent, and by the time they applied for the permit, it was a 12-inch pipeline, which is, I think, illustrative of how fast the demand and how fast the supply is growing and the production levels. So fortunately, they were able to hopefully propose a large enough pipeline. The line will have an initial capacity of 60,000 barrels per day with a potential capacity of about 110,000 barrels per day with at least one additional pumping station. It'll include a truck terminal storage tanks and pump facility at the north end of the pipeline and a second one that'll be constructed near the intersection of the pipeline at North Dakota Highway 200. If constructed as a single project with one construction crew, it would add about 50 construction workers, of which about 40% to 50% will be hired from the regional labor pool. However, they did testify that the company anticipates using four separate construction crews, which of course would increase the total number of workers at any one time to between 150 and 200 and obviously shorten the construction timeline. I'll spare you a lot of the rest of the details other than to say that we did have a good hearing in Kildare. It was a pretty full house. One of the more interesting, I think, pieces of testimony was the fact that this particular project will take about 300 trucks off of the roads, which is, of course, a very important advantage to pipelines beyond the obvious economics and efficiency of moving crude oil by pipeline as opposed to trucks. Also, one of the more interesting, I think, aspects of this project is that besides having access to the Guernsey market through the Belle Fouche and Baker system that the True Oil Company owns, as well as owning, of course, this system, is that it would also have an opportunity to tie into the Trans-Canada Keystone XL line, which intends to take, for the most part, Alberta tar sands crude, I guess, to Cushing, Oklahoma, and down to the Gulf Coast. TransCanada, of course, announced last week or maybe just prior to that the open season for access and for markets and production to get on that XL line. So while there's still some, I guess, thought that, whether or not that line will actually be built, there's great optimism in the oil industry that it will, in fact, be built. And so Bridger is trying to get ahead of the curve and perhaps get some North Dakota crude into that XL line, which is fantastic for our producers because, of course, at the Gulf Coast and at Cushing, Oklahoma, not only do they not pay a discount, but they'll pay a premium for a sweet crude, the type that comes out of the Bakken. So all very interesting stuff. We had nobody at the hearing that opposed this project. We did have some folks testify in favor of it, including a very enthusiastic county commissioner who was most pleased about getting those trucks off the highways. So everything seems to be in order.
I think Kevin did a great job of explaining a lot of the impacts of transportation, but this pipeline, there was a lot of things that had come up on this that we perhaps hadn't seen in a while. And one of the most intriguing to me was that there's a lot of cultural artifacts in this route. And so as we went through the hearing, we had a lot of questions about, you know, how they would deal with those. And they made a nice micro-siting changes to avoid the cultural areas, the Native American wintering over grounds, if you will. So there's a lot of cultural things we saw. And this pipeline also crosses the Little Missouri. So we had a lot of questions about special features in the pipeline as it crosses under the Little Missouri. They're going to make the pipe a little bit stronger in those areas and have backflows on both sides of the river. So we had a lot of questions about that. The third thing that we questioned a lot about was, as most of you are aware of, the oil, quote-unquote, spill we had out in the Kilder area. I asked a lot of questions about their response plans if something happens to this pipeline. They've got a very good system of flow meters put in place. They've got a very good response plan out there. So, I mean, this project moved along very quickly, but the company really did a good job of setting up the stage for us to answer the questions, and they had all the answers right there. I just think this is a good example of a company doing their homework long before they get to the hearing, and then when our questions come, they're able to answer them. We'll get back, able to review it, and then quickly get to a decision. Because, for me, the overriding factor was they've met all the requirements, but we just saw another fatality in northwestern North Dakota with a truck just the other day. So the sooner we can get these trucks off the road, the better that is for that region.
One of the unique features about this, and I think was helpful for me with regard to the Little Missouri crossing, is they were able to use effectively the same crossing as the Dakota Gas CO2 line used. And knowing that it's a site where one has been successfully put in was helpful. But the company also did a very good job of explaining exactly how they'd be drilling under the Little Missouri River to give us assurance that could be done well. In addition, one of the things that we've begun asking in a lot of these hearings, and we did here as well, is with regard to housing shortages in that part of the state. There are some accommodations that have been made so that when this does start construction, there will be places for the workers to live. One of the things that will make it somewhat easier as well is this is going to be a very fast-moving project as far as the construction timetable. So it won't perhaps have quite as much impact on housing shortages as some longer construction projects might.
Yeah, in fact, I was thinking about, some of those of you that might remember the Trans-Canada Keystone project, which was a much larger project, much longer project, but it had similar features in that there were some very sensitive areas that it went through, and the HDD, horizontal directional drilling, the pull of that pipe underneath the Little Missouri River was very important, and Tony's exactly right. Its proximity to the CO2 line was interesting, but when you look at the images, the satellite images of the area, you also realize that any one of us could probably go out and say this would be a good place to cross because it was the clearest and flattest and probably the easiest terrain to both access and maneuver through. So anyway, they did do a good job. I should be clear though that while we acted rather quickly, it was less than 2 months from the application being filed and the order being issued. The letter of intent hung around quite a while. In fact, it hung around a fair bit longer than the company had originally intended, and that is because they were making those adjustments that made for a much better application and a much smoother hearing rather than, bringing a less complete and a proper filing to us. So everyone did a good job, and we're used to working with K2 Engineering as well, who does a good job for them on the environmental side.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Casey 6. I move the commission deem the application complete and issue a notice of filing and a notice of hearing in the request of Bear Paw Energy, LLC, for a certificate of site compatibility for the construction and operation of a 100 million standard cubic feet per day gas processing plant in McKenzie County of North Dakota, case number PU-10568.
Second.
This application, we received this application on September 10th of this year, although we've had the letter of intent for a little bit longer than that. It's what they propose is the Garden Creek plant, which would be located about 4.5 miles northeast of Watford City, and it would be constructed on an 80-acre plot in that area. It has a design capacity of 100 million square cubic feet per day, utilizing a cryogenic turbo expander process, and Commissioner Culk's going to explain that process here in a little bit. But the interesting thing about it is 100 million cubic feet per day is our threshold for siting a energy conversion facility of this type. We have some larger ones, and as you know, might remember, we just recently issued an order on the 250 million cubic feet. I guess it was an expansion to 250 million cubic feet of the Hess plant, and we have some smaller ones, a number of smaller plants in western North Dakota, but we're starting to see a lot more gas processing take place. It will process associated natural gas from oil production wells, of course, connected to Bear Paw's gathering system, which, by the way, as you read some things about Bear Paw, one of the things that struck me was the fact that I think they in their app, it said they have about 3,700 miles of gas gathering lines, and you think that about how much that is. It just blows me away. And we've often wondered how many gathering lines there are out there, but here's one company that testifies to having 3,700 miles of it, and I'm sure somebody knows where it all is. The anticipated investment for this facility is about $150 to $175 million. They anticipate that the plant commissioning activities will begin in November of 2011, followed by full in-service date approximately 30 to 45 days later. And site work, including restoration, may continue through May of 2012. Interesting stuff, of course, as in previous gas cases that we've talked about, there will be the... In the processing process, there's actually a market for the NGLs, or the natural gas liquids, which is not completely new to us, but becoming more and more common because there's more of a market for it. And, of course, with the rail facilities that we now have, they're able to get some of that product to market, as well as the more traditional gases that we're used to, like methane, for example, and natural gasoline, things like this. So anyway, everything seems to be in order, and we look forward to citing another hopefully successful gas processing facility and see a lot less flaring going on in western North Dakota.
And we'll be setting the actual hearing date at our work session as soon as this is, informal as soon as this is done.
Yeah, and let's, good reminder, by the way, make sure that we get that those dates to the interested media right away.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Finally for me, KC7, I move the Commission issue a notice of hearing regarding Enbridge Pipelines, North Dakota, LLC's request that the Commission supersede and preempt the City of Berthold's zoning decision for Berthold Station upgrades in Ward County of North Dakota, case number PU-10130.
Second.
As you no doubt recall, after our hearing the case on the Enbridge Pipelines' proposed expansion of its Berthold Station, the City of Berthold denied the company's zoning changes request. I think their zoning request was for a change from agriculture to industrial, and it was denied by the City of Berthold. Of course, our order, as always, is conditioned on compliance with all local zoning regulations. The City and Enbridge seemed to, at least at this point, be at some sort of an impasse, so the company filed a motion this week for the PSC to supersede and preempt the application of Berthold's zoning ordinance, overriding, in essence, the City of Berthold. And so the purpose of today's motion is to notice a hearing on Enbridge's motion. Again, we will find the date and time and fill in those blanks at the admin portion of the meeting. It's, of course, important to note that the burden is on the company to show by preponderance of the evidence that the zoning regulations of the city of Berthold are unreasonably restrictive in view of existing technology factors of cost or economics or needs of consumers regardless of their location. And so those will all be facts that we'll have to hear at another hearing. We have, of course, received that motion. We've all read the company's motion, have not, of course, yet heard from the city of Berthold. So it's it's unclear as to what the arguments might be the other way, but that's what we're here for, and that's what the hearings are for. Now, again, that's where it is today. Who knows what what an action like this might prompt? As I always say, every case really is a negotiation until we vote. So we'll see.
Yeah. Only thing I would add on this is that it's to try to make it clear, I guess, that the commission has different authority to do different things. If a county decides to zone out wind turbines, we don't have the ability to go into that county and place wind turbines. But in this particular case, since it's considered a transmission line, the commission does have authority, if there's a reason to do it, to override a local authority. That, by, of course, doesn't mean we're going to do that. But we'll go back out and have the hearing. We'll see what their arguments are. But during the first hearing, there was many issues at play, but it seemed as we left the hearing that those things would work themselves out, but obviously they didn't. So we look forward to setting that hearing date and going back up there and hearing the arguments.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That ends the items in my portfolio. Tony, did you want to read your motions, or would you like somebody else to?
Well, if one of you would handle it, that would be great. They're all contained on the phone I'm talking on.
Sure. Oh. but of course, the explanation is embedded in your brain. Okay, I can go ahead and do that. I move the commission issue an order in case number GE-10578, granting the request of Trinidad Benham Corporation to operate a 204,000-bushel grain warehouse at Pillsbury, North Dakota. I further move the commission grant the request of Trinidad Benham Corporation to operate the grain warehouse at Pillsbury, North Dakota on an as-needed basis.
Second.
Yeah, both of these items that are on my agenda are both stations that are going to be receiving grain, but will be operating only as needed.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And TC2, I move the commission to issue an order in case number GE-10583, granting the request of Demeter, 1993 Inc., DBA, Viterra, to operate a 37,000-bushel grain warehouse at Candu, North Dakota. I further move the commission grant the request of Demeter, 1993 Inc., DBA, Viterra, to operate the grain warehouse at Candu, North Dakota on an as-needed basis.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Commissioner Kolk.
Good afternoon. Item BK1. I move the commission adopt the order approving electric service area agreement and issue Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity number 5422 to Otter Tail Power Company, authorizing the extension of electric services to customers around the city of Garrison, North Dakota, as established by the Electric Service Area Agreement, case numbers PU10334 and PU10417.
Second.
Basically, we've got combined cases here of the Service Area Agreement and the PCNN. In July of this year, we received paperwork from Otter Tail and McLean Electric that they filed a joint application for approval of a Service Area Agreement to establish service areas around the city of Garrison. Otter Tail further wants us to issue the PCNN. On July 14th of this year, the commission issued notice of filing, notice of informal hearing, and notice of opportunity for hearing. We did not receive anything back from those. On September of this year, we discussed the issue amongst ourselves. We also had the applicants down for an informal hearing and basically went through that this will help both groups have certainty for as they plan and efficiently operate the electricity needs of that area. There will not be unreasonable duplications. They'll all have good reliability and apply to service standards. And, to my opinion, the biggest part of this is the last part where this will avoid territorial disputes between the parties in the future. I think that it's a great thing when we get investor-owned utilities and co-ops are able to sit down when there's not a contested issue and set up these kind of agreements. So with that, I would encourage we approve this and pass this today.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, item BK2. I move the commission adopt the order certifying use of federal universal service support for rural eligible telecommunication carriers to receive federal universal service funding in 2011. Case number PU10476.
Second.
The little background, the Telecommunication Act of 1996 requires that telecommunication carriers that use USF funds be only used for provision, maintenance, and upgrading of facilities and services for which support is intended. The FCC sets some guidance out there that requires each state public utility authority, which would be us in this case, to provide an annual certification to the FCC to ensure that the telecommunication carriers are using these funds as required. The way it was set up by this commission is that each company will file an affidavit with us by September 14th of each year, as described in the order certifying that they'll use these funds only for the provision, maintenance, and upgrading of the facilities in the manner that was intended. So it is interesting that we have limited jurisdiction over telecommunication carriers, but the way this is set up where the companies that have this status that we grant them in the beginning tell us they're going to use the funds in the right manner, they swear by affidavit, and that, quite honestly, is the way that we verify that. There was some question that I had, quite honestly, if we had to dig a little deeper on actually reviewing some of this, that actually I'm going to follow through up on, because kind of a separate issue, the National Broadband Plan talks a lot about restructuring and changing USF funds, so it'll be interesting how USF funds may change in the future. But with that, there are 44 companies that are contained in this order that we received affidavits from, and I would urge passage of this motion.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
And that concludes the items in my portfolio.
Very good. Just a couple of announcements I think of interest that I want to highlight between now and our next meeting. Tomorrow we do have an informal hearing on the advanced determination of prudence for CapEx 2020. That's both for Otter Tail Power Company and Northern States Power Company. As you recall, we've had one hearing on a settlement agreement between staff and the company, a few work sessions, a new attorney, and more questions and few answers, and the company asked for another opportunity to have an informal, and I think for all of our sakes, that was probably a good a good request, and we're wise to honor it. So, again, tomorrow, being at 9 a.m. here in the hearing room, we'll have that informal hearing. Also, then Monday, September 27th, Keystone Pipeline will come in for a presentation more to update us on reclamation activities and just where they are with regard to North Dakota landowners and North Dakota issues as we try to hopefully wrap up all post-construction for the Trans-Canada Keystone Pipeline. Are there any other announcements I'm forgetting, guys, that I should be highlighting? If not, we could answer some questions if you have some.
I'm sorry. Can you tell me again, when is the informal on CapEx 2020?
Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.
Okay. Yep. And when is the meeting with the Keystone folks?
September 27th at 10 a.m.
10 a.m. here?
Here,
okay.
Yes.
Speaking of Keystone, on the consent agenda, there is a
tree and shrub plan.
Tree and shrub
plan.
Oh,
yeah.
What is that?
Well, they, you know, as part of the motion or as part of the order, of course, they have to submit a tree and shrub mitigation plan. They've submitted that, and you know, we just have approved it. It was a little bit different. It was a little less site specific, which probably makes some sense considering it was 600 landowners and 260 miles or so, something like that. But it had the most important aspects of that particular mitigation plan were there. That they're working with both the North Dakota Forest Service as well as the Soil Conservation Service.
The Freedom Mine case, mm-hmm. How was that resolved?
Well, it's resolved by them paying the fine and withdrawing.
How much was the fine?
$1,000. $250 for seriousness and $750 for negligence.
Okay. And can you explain to me what an energy dissipator is?
I bet Jim can. it's really the sort of the exhaust system of the whole process.
It's something that goes on the end of a discharge pipe to basically diffuse the water so it doesn't all just shoot out in one area.
So it's like putting your thumb over the garden hose.
That's exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Could you just explain for me again what the violation was?
I can. I'm going to pull it up so I get it just right.
So So it's basically you had a pipe or something spraying out water in a stream.
It was really a couple things. I mean, it was a pond discharge that resulted in some minor erosion, and it was outside of the permit area. So the violation was issued for failure to have an energy dissipator on the discharge outlet of the pond, and then for locating the discharge pipe beyond the permit boundary, which is, of course, required by law that it be within the boundary. So that was those two issues that resulted in the violation.
And what is the purpose of the pond?
Well, the purpose of the pond, of course, is to collect water before it gets into the natural system, if you will, and ensure that the water is some purified before it's put back into nature.
Is there some sort of, I mean, when the pond collects the water, is there something about the water that necessitates the pond? If that's...
Sure, because, sure there is. Of course, the water, when it comes out after the mining process or through the mining process, could have who knows what, all kinds of stuff in it, sediment, of course, especially. And so by a pond collecting it first, the sediment can then settle and then provide cleaner, more pure water that would be put back into nature.
So essentially, you have water running into this pond. It has
sediment
in the mining process.
Sure,
the sediment.
Sediment
settles.
Is as we call it.
The sediment settles, then you discharge.
Then discharge the water.
Non-sedimented water.
And that's the simplest. That's the simplest version. Yeah, non-sedimented water. Yeah, right.
And as it sits there longer, the wind blows and the oxygen gets added back to the water, and just helps the water get back the way it should be.
Can you tell me what the cost of the Bridger Pipeline project is?
$29 million.
$29 million. Okay, and the hearing in Kilder was September 9th?
Sounds about right.
Okay. Boy, is it right?
I'm going to check for sure. Okay. It was September 9th.
And I'm just wanting to make sure I wrote this down correctly on the Bear Paw Energy timeline. Mm-hmm. It's going to cost between $150 and $175 million to build. They hope to have it in service by late December 2011 or early January 2012.
That sounds about right. They anticipate that the plant commissioning activities will begin in November of 2011, followed by full in-service date about 30 to 45 days later.
Okay. Yeah. And they anticipate doing site work up until May 2012.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay. As far as Enbridge is concerned, I was out of the room for a short time. Did you schedule that hearing?
We will in our admin meeting. So we, in fact, I don't even know for sure, well, we'll find out about even location and things, because we had the original hearing at the school, but of course school wasn't in session. Now that school's in session, I'm not sure what kind of rooms are available right in Berthold or whether we'll have to go to another facility somewhere.
You need a very large room, too.
Yeah, it may be a big room.
Is there a basketball gym at the school? Or?
I'm sure there is, yeah.
The can you just explain how high a barrier is it for the commission to override a local authority's decision?
Well, it's a very good question, and it's one that I've been, as Alana will tell you, pondering, if you excuse the expression, quite a bit today. The standard, of course, for any administrative action is preponderance of the evidence, or the greater weight of the evidence, and it is obviously a more subjective standard than is, the more common things like clear and convincing evidence, which is typical of a civil matter, or beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case or something like that. So it is a bit more subjective. Greater weight of the evidence, of course, is based on more convincing evidence, and probably truth or accuracy related, as opposed to a mountain of evidence, if you will. Another type of a standard might require a lot of evidence, whereas preponderance of the evidence allows us our subjectivity, as well as, by the way, our expertise, to have a bit more weight. So it's a fairly high standard. What I'm most interested in, and I haven't looked at a lot yet, Dale, is precedent. So preponderance of the evidence, that's a nice standard, and it's subjective. But what other cases have there been that we can relate this to? One of the things that struck me about reading the company's filing, for example, is that some of the facts that they brought into the filing were not facts in the original case, which you know, I didn't know whether to be disturbed by that or just curious about it, but I am at the very least curious about it. At the same time, all of the facts that were brought into the original case, I thought were pretty well addressed in our order. So clearly, it seems like there must have been some other breakdown after the hearing between the city and the company. Again, I don't know that there was or there wasn't, but just, again, reading their filing, it did raise some questions in my mind.
Well, there's just some terminology, you know, unreasonably restrictive, you know, factors of cost or economy. So cost is, how do you measure the cost? You know, the state, the country, their whole, I mean, needs of consumers regardless of location. So there's some things that we really have to go through to measure how we're going to compare these things back and forth.
I mean, when you talk about facts not in the original case, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about things like one of the facts, the missile silo, the 2,000-foot barrier around the missile silo on the west side of the railroad tracks, which is evidently where the city wants to have them consider moving this pumping station. Well, I don't remember a missile silo ever even being discussed at the hearing, but certainly it wasn't a factor that I recall considering.
One of the things that all three of us tried to put out to the folks as they gave us their viewpoints was that this is not like a wind turbine, once again, where if you don't like location Hilltop 1, we can move it to Hilltop 2. We were here to decide on this location if it met the requirements, and folks were testifying they wanted us to move it somewhere else. So that's not what we do. And so I sense that's going to be some of the things we're going to hear again. But we're back there to decide whether it goes in this location. We don't have the ability or the authority to move it anywhere else.
You know, the issue of the factors, especially of things like cost or economy, that's where that standard, okay, there's a factor of that, but what is the standard? Is it in the context of a $520 million pipeline? Is it in the context of the pricing differential for North Dakota producers? Is it in the context of the price of gasoline at the pump for the end user? Because, of course, the statute refers to consumers regardless of where they might be located. And so those are things that I guess I don't know for sure yet, but I would hope for some clear explanation at a hearing if this doesn't spur some other action beforehand.
Because when I was reading this, I was thinking, you know, frankly, the community, the governing board has a lot of leverage here, and Enbridge is asking you to take away their leverage.
The problem is that if I might just opine a moment, the community of Berthold has a lot of leverage until this happens. And then, you know, to me the question becomes for the city of Berthold, at what point have we given up our leverage? But that's why we're here. If there's an unresolvable dispute between two parties that we get to adjudicate, and it comes to that unresolved or impasse, then nobody has leverage at that point. The only leverage you have is when you're still negotiating.
And if I understood Commissioner Call correctly, basically your decision is either you decide to override the governing board or you don't.
That's correct. Our current order.
You can't tell them to move it anywhere else.
That's right. Our current order is, of course, conditioned on compliance with local zoning ordinances. The burden of proof in this case, of course, is on the company to prove by the greater weight of the evidence that this zoning ordinance is unreasonably restrictive by those various factors that we discussed. If they can't prove that, then, of course, our order is null and void, and then they might have to take some other, you know, who knows what other action they might be able to take or what other avenue. The thing is, they started here, and so it's going to probably have to end here.
Because I was kind of skimming the filing by the attorney for Enbridge and the affidavit by the gentleman who's he's an administrator up there. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like what their arguments were is that the community wants us to move this to another location, but moving that would be more expensive, and it also would not, in the company's estimation, resolve the safety concerns that are put forth by local folks. And also there's the discussion about, well, we can't build this facility on the land that the community would like us, or the city council would like us to build it on anyway, because it's too close to a nuclear missile. And you didn't hear anything at all about the nuclear missile?
We did not. It was right. It wasn't part of the area that we were discussing. course, it wasn't part of the application. That wasn't part of the area that, that they were applying for a site certificate. But nor was it ever raised, though, in terms of as a defense for moving it, for not moving it to the other side. And I do think there's some obligation to do that. Once a charge is made by another party, I mean, you know, the weight of evidence shifts back and forth a little bit, and it was never raised. No, I'm not saying that they were obligated to raise it. They were, you know, asking for a site on the east side.
Well, do you know if they're aware of it?
I don't know that. I don't know that. And I guess that's the curiosity in me.
Well, and that's why what Brian had mentioned is important. I mean, it's not as if the commission has had in front of it, do you want it here or do you want it here or
right.
do you want it in this third location. There's literally just one application before you regarding that specific site and whether that specific site makes the standard of state law. And so it's important to keep that in mind, that it's really an up or down on that specific site. And whatever happens coming out of this, it can have implications. Whether there would be other sites that might be reviewed.
Right.
And as far as the garrison service area agreement.
Oh, sure.
I'm trying to remember how many. There's Bismarck, there's Kindred.
Jamestown
there's
has
Jamestown.
Castleton.
Castleton. And is this the fifth one? I'm trying just to remember. Do you know? Do you remember?
Boy.
I'm going to have to get back to you on that, Dale, because I don't know off the top of my head how many we have.
There might be one or two more. It just seems to me like there should be. But Jerry might remember if he was here. But
we can look that up and get back to you, Dale. Okay. But I do. I was up in Garrison just after we had the work session. I was driving through the town. And it's good when they do this ahead of time. I did ask the question what prompted it. Apparently there was some – the city had to renew some power agreements, and so that really prompted all the parties to sit down and do this. But I think it's a great idea whenever the city and the investor owns and the co-ops do this ahead of time when it's not a contested case.
Yeah, franchise time's a good time to.
Is there any way that you can, like, summarize who gets what territory in this?
Well, basically, they drew a line around Garrison, the Northwestern, the airport, and all the facilities, I guess, southeast of there. We'll stick with Otter Tail. And then straight south of town, Otter Tail picked up some territory that may have been a McLean Electric's. And really, that was about it. So you could say Otter Tail would have the city of Garrison looping around the airport and then straight south of there about a square mile.
Okay. Let me see. You have to schedule the Enbridge hearing and another one. Am I?
The Bearpaw.
Bearpaw. Yeah. Yes. Are you going to be doing that fairly quickly?
We are. In
Probably
fact,
right
I think
now.
We got to go right to it because Tony's on the phone. And so let's go right into our admin portion of the agenda. Is that okay, Tony?
Yeah, that works for me.
Okay, and then we'll, in fact, then let's go right to scheduling those two issues.